Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.06 on the West Coast, 11:06 on the East Coast. I think George is on East Coast time. George, you're on East Coast time?
That is correct. It is, yes it is. Thank God, that gives me a little extra sleep, you know?
You know, I am the panhandle of Florida, which runs underneath you, kind of, sort of, the western edge of it is in the central time zone. I didn't know that until like the last year. I was like, "What?"
You know, I didn't know that either. You know, I've got a good friend who works for GE up in Kentucky, and even though he's, you know, 5 hours north, almost in a straight shot, he's not too far west of us. He's in Central Time as well. It really throws me through a loop anytime I go to visit him. I gotta tell you, man, the time zone thing. I don't know about this.
It's different.
It makes perfect sense to some extent, unless you're near the border. Between two time zones.
Yeah, then it sucks. And you'll see a lot of, for instance, there's towns, I know this, there's towns in western North Dakota that are kind of on the western edge of the central time zone, but they do a lot of business with the population just east of, or just west of them. And so their business hours are mountain time business hours, not central time top. Because they simply don't lend themselves.
I mean, I need to do that, right? Because otherwise every email would have to end with what time you intend to meet for lunch and in parentheses, which time zone you mean.
Yeah.
Right?
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Although, to be fair, that is why they came up with time zones in the first place, right? Because when we were first starting to conduct business over long distances, noon, you know, where the sun is highest and its point in the sky for you wasn't the same as noon. For the guy who lived a six-hour, you know, hike away. So they had to establish these time zones so that we'd have a way to meet for lunch, I suppose. But, you know, now that we're in 2018, I'm happy to just look at my phone and have it tell me what time it is.
There you go.
I don't need any of this.
Simplifies it for everybody. You know, now I'm kind of curious. When did time zones get embedded? Do you know?
I don't know offhand. I'm pretty confident that it was an early development. You know, I'm talking about my
early.
Ass, right?
Okay. So
Rome era, you know?
I'm gonna tell you what they are. But since you're gonna play the stupid guy, okay? You're gonna play. This is gonna be one of those like late night interviews with like people on the street. So when do you think?
Perfect.
When do you think time zones? Give me. Your guess, when do you think time zones were adopted?
My pitch is in the Roman era. Sometime during the Roman Empire, time zones were invented to help make uniform trade across the Roman Empire. That's my pitch.
That's your pick? That's your final answer?
That's my final answer. You know, sometime like, I don't know, late BC, early AD era. You know, like... 50 BC and sooner.
All right. Scottish-born Canadian Sir Sanford Fleming proposed a worldwide time system in 1879. He advocated this system.
See, but you're saying a worldwide time system.
Yeah.
See, Rome wouldn't have had, that's a different question. You're cheating now. You can't move the goalposts. It said the first time zones, not the first uniformly accepted across the globe concept of time.
Oh, now you're going to tweak this so you can be right? Is that the game we're going to play?
I mean, I do analysis for a living. My job is to argue with people on the internet. Of course, I would tweak this to
God,
make me right.
What a hellish existence to argue with.
It is, man. I got to tell you. You take the bad with the good.
Oh, my God. Is there any good?
I'm in my pajamas on a Monday.
That would be where the good would have to be, because it certainly is not coming for the intellectual interactions that you're going to experience on the internet.
I've had to implement some pretty strict rules about that.
Before clocks were invented, people kept time using different instruments to observe the sun's median passing at noon. The earliest time measuring devices we know are of are sundials and water clocks. So, I mean, really, a sundial is its own form of time zone, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. The pendulum clock was developed during the 17th century. However, these clocks were not sufficiently accurate to be used at sea to determine longitude and for scientific time measurements in the 18th century.
That blows my mind, the concept of traveling at sea using a timekeeping device and an astrolabe.
How about that?
Looking at the stars to determine where... It blows my... I can't even wrap my head around the concept. It's absolutely incredible.
In 1764, the chronometer was invented. Chronometers measured time accurately in spite of motion or varying conditions and became popular instruments among many merchant mariners during the 19th century. After the chronometer, many towns and cities set clocks based on sunsets and sunrises. Dawn and dusk occurred at different times, but time differences between distant locations were barely noticeable before the 19th century because of long travel times and the lack of long-distance communications. So it really didn't matter.
That was the death nail in my argument.
The Romans really didn't care, because it took you so long to get there, you would be...
But it didn't matter.
It didn't matter. Now, it only becomes an issue when travel becomes quicker. And then...
That makes perfect sense, yeah.
Doesn't it? Nobody cares. Honestly, what time is it in Cairo?
I wonder if the advent of the train really forced...
Ooh.
You know?
Wow. Listen to you. I wonder, what time is it in Cairo? Who cares? Good question.
Yeah. Which arguably is something you could still hear me say. That's probably the number one thing I use Alexa for here in my house while I'm working. Is just trying to determine what time it is someplace so I can decide if it's rude that I call this guy right now.
So
it's like, Alexa, what time is it in Egypt? Am I going to wake this guy up? And almost always the answer is yes.
Do you realize Alexa is collecting on you?
Oh, absolutely. It's the spy in my living room. Yeah. I mean, it's not the only one. I've got Siri in here too. I'm pretty sure my wife's PlayStation listens to you. There's no privacy left in this world, let alone in my house.
As long as you're good with it. Now, final trivia question before we start talking about something else. How many miles do you think there are between Louisiana, which is at the base of the Mississippi River, okay, and so the eastern border of Louisiana and the western border of Florida? How many miles do you think are between those two geographical...
This is the furthest thing from my strong suit. I mean, I'd imagine not that many, right? I mean...
Well, we're not asking you to imagine. We're asking you to answer the question.
Oh, man. I don't know. 500 miles.
236 miles.
See, this is a problem that I have regularly when it comes to geography, is that in my head, I can kind of picture states' locations as they appear like on a fifth grader's map that you color in with colored pencils.
Right, and what time zone is Florida in on that map?
The East Coast time zone.
Exactly. So imagine my shock a year ago when I'm talking to somebody in Florida and getting them to come on the program, and okay, it'll be 8 o'clock my time, and so 11 o'clock your time. And he said, no, it'll be 10. I said, are you traveling? He said, no, I'm in Florida. I said, wait a minute, there's a part of Florida that's in the central time zone? And he said, hello.
All right, that's where I'm going to draw the line. That's where I would take issue. Why on earth would I assume? Yeah. This is part of Florida. This is the central time zone.
Yes, 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 yes. Who knew? I didn't know that. And he started laughing.
Wait, is this the sort of thing you vote on by county? Is that how you determine what time zone you're in?
I don't know.
One would hope that it was a more formal process than that.
One would hope, but I did not know that. And I said, are you...
I'm going to run for mayor of Dawson, Bill, and I'm going to slow watch on Pacific time.
We want to be on Pacific time.
Give us a heads up.
Exactly.
We'll be 3 hours ahead of the competition out here.
So I found that interesting. And so then you start looking at the Earth and you look at, you know, time zones. So listen to this. This is interesting. Okay. This gives you some, because I agree, your fourth grade geography map. Okay. The western edge of Florida is east of Birmingham, Alabama, Nashville, Tennessee. Okay. It's east of Indianapolis. And it's almost along the same longitude line as Chicago. If you take a line from Chicago, you draw it south.
All right, I'm looking at the map now. I'm getting it.
You're getting savvy? It's like, who knew?
Yeah, now I'm catching up.
Who knew? Like, I didn't know the panhandle stretched. I mean, I know Florida has a panhandle. I didn't realize it went that far.
That is a good point. I genuinely never really thought of it either.
Yeah.
And it comes back to that, you know, my fifth grade geography class. I picture these things, like, in terms of regions. You know, I very rarely imagine the South as it relates to the Midwest, right? I just think of the South. Same thing with New England. I don't consider how far east Maine goes. Maine sticks out way further than Florida out into the Atlantic Ocean.
Not even close. Not even close.
You know, these aren't things that I ever really think about.
Well, maybe in, you know, between conversations with Siri and the rest of the spies in your home, maybe you should get some... No, this stuff only comes across your you know, darkens your doorstep when somebody darkens it, when somebody brings it to you. And you're like, holy smokes.
I'll tell you, I've struggled with geography my whole life. I've always been a very good student. But geography... I can't picture things in my head. I can't picture. I think this is why I take to writing so well. There's a word for it. I was diagnosed with it as a kid, but my brain just thinks in terms of words and language much more so than imagery. So I have trouble picturing things.
Do you have problems with?
Do
you have problems with east, west, north, south? You need to go straight, backwards, left, and right.
I don't have any issues with that. I guess. In theory, I haven't run into a situation where I have trouble with that. It's more along the lines of, like, I couldn't, for instance, I know what you look like, but I can't picture your face in my head. I could describe you, but I can't picture it. And because of that, I've always had trouble filling out maps. And anybody who follows me on Instagram probably has noticed, my desk has a gigantic mouse pad on it. The mouse pad, like, literally covers the whole front half of my desk.
Yes.
And it's a map of the world.
Oh.
And that's not just because I thought that it was, like, an interesting decorative piece. It's because when I'm covering stories, you know, in a place like Yemen or something like that, I have a lot of trouble understanding where Yemen is in relation to other countries that it doesn't regularly deal with. I know where Yemen is.
That's a good thing to do, though. I think, let me tell you, and the other thing I think is looking at a map, you know, you get... And it was hard to find these until, you know, the advent of the internet, but it's better to have a topographical map as opposed to a political map, because you can see, you know, why things are divided the way they are. For instance, if you look at a map of Africa, you can see the brown part of Africa and you can see the green part of Africa.
Absolutely.
And so there's, you know, in the brown part.
And a lot of times the borders in a lot of parts of the world you'll find mirror these shifts in vegetation or waterways, things like that. A lot of times these natural borders ended up becoming our political borders.
Exactly.
With the exception of places like the Middle East and stuff like that where we kind of went.
Where the Brits went in there and drew lines to, so just so they could foster wars for centuries. So we owe the Brits and the French
job
a huge,
what they were looking at.
Yeah, huge thank you for being ass clowns. Yeah, just shove them together. The Czechs and the Slovaks, don't they like each other? I don't really know, but here you go. Down this river through this valley.
The Kurds will get along real well with everybody.
Exactly. The Sunnis, the Shiites, the Kurds. Put it all together. What do we call it? I don't know. I've been racking my brain. How about this? Iraq. You racked your brain. Iraq. There you go. Nice, Mac. You should be in government. I know. I'm brilliant. You know, shit like that, the Brits. What a bunch of ass clowns. Email, what do both of you think about President Trump's comments about Secretary of Defense Mattis calling him his Democrat or a Democrat?
You're going to get me to grumble this early. It's early in the show, and I'm already getting pissed. I think it was inappropriate, and I'll tell you why I think it was inappropriate. Coming from most politicians, saying, you know, he's kind of a Republican or he's kind of a Democrat, might not be a loaded term. Donald Trump has made a point to paint the other political party as the enemy of his political party. I mean, it's not just Donald Trump who does this, but he definitely participates in this idea of identity politics. So when you say your own Secretary of Defense is a member of the other team, you're really discrediting his position. I don't see any way that Mattis ends up staying in the administration long term at this point if Donald Trump is coming out and making remarks like this. My tinfoil hat theory, I think that it was politically motivated because Mattis is more popular than Trump among more moderate Republicans. So for Trump to come out and say he's basically a Democrat really takes the feet out from under anybody's suppositions about Mattis potentially challenging him in the primaries. Assuming things go poorly in the midterm elections. If they go well, Trump will have no trouble in the primary. Honestly, I think that he thinks Mattis is too popular, and he was trying to cut him down. And I think that that's shitty. Your silence makes me think you agree.
Wait, say that again?
I said your silence makes me think that you might not agree. I genuinely think that it was a calculated decision. I don't think it was an off-the-cuff remark.
Oh, no,
no,
he doesn't do... Here's what I think. I think that Mattis got sideways with the president when he didn't, you know, carry his water with the transgender thing, and made the president look a bit foolish.
I think it was that, and I also think it was that Mattis has pretty consistently encouraged the administration to engage Congress about or taking military action in places like Syria and things like that. It makes him seem like he's not a team player. However, I would argue that one of the reasons Mattis didn't become the commandant of the Marine Corps was because he was butting heads with Obama about his policy in Iran. Mattis has pretty consistently shown us that he doesn't let politics influence his policy decisions. National security is his interest, not elections, at least thus far. I don't know. I think making the Secretary of Defense a partisan position is a crappy thing to do.
No, and I'll tell you what, I think he's the most, he has the most credibility of any member. And I will tell you what, Nikki Haley's got a lot of credibility because I think the way she's conducted herself.
Yeah, I do like Nikki Haley a lot.
You know, and I think Mike Pompeo is gaining credibility, but he's, you know, he was at the CIA, so now he's much more engaged on the global stage. I think Pompeo is gaining credibility, but nobody has the credibility in that administration, in my opinion, as the Secretary of Defense does. Wherever he goes around the world, you do not see him ridiculed or put the ass hat on. You know, wherever he goes, I mean, he says what he means. He's very disciplined in the things he says. He tends to be on the right side of issues and tends to have a longer view, all of which, you know, it's tough to find fault with. So I think
and
that...
And if you were Donald Trump looking to start your reelection campaign, which he already obviously is, I would leverage that. Assuming Mattis was willing to play ball, I would leverage the fact that people see Mattis as the voice of reason in the room. I would use Mattis to go and try to advance some of my policies that maybe wouldn't be that well received when they come from Donald Trump's mouth. Instead, though, he seems to be trying to undermine Mattis's popularity. I don't know why, but regardless of why, when he's the most respected and reputable member of your cabinet, that's the wrong move. You know, I don't like it. I really don't.
Yeah.
I do respect the fact that Mattis didn't jump right out and issue a response. you know, the Pentagon came back and said, you know, he's laser focused on national defense, which is probably just what he would say. I don't know, though. I really don't like this idea of calling each other names within the same team. If Tom Brady came out and said, you know, Wes Welker's not playing for the Patriots anymore, but the first name that came to mind, well, Wes Welker's practically a Buffalo Bill. You know, we wouldn't think that they were going into the big game with the right head. Geopolitics is no different. We're supposed to be on the same team when it comes to the Secretary of Defense, the President of the United States, and so forth. And when they're calling each other names, when the President is calling the Secretary of Defense names in the media and insinuating he may be leaving soon, it really discredits Mattis when he goes to Vietnam right now and is trying to negotiate more U.S. influence in Vietnam to counter China.
I don't really think it does, though. You know, to me, they're like, hey, when they see Mattis, they know they're dealing with an adult, right? Hey.
Yeah, but if Mattis is going to be gone next week, why am I going to shake hands with you? I'll have to renegotiate with the next guy in a week. You know, this is the problem with broadcasting that senior officials are on borrowed time. You know, just like Rex Tillerson going to meet with Kim Jong-un. If I were Kim Jong-un, I'd be like, I'm just going to wait this out and meet with the next guy. Mike Pompeo will be here in 2 weeks.
No, that's a valid point. To me, though, he's got so much credibility. And I don't know. It's just an odd time that the president would pick a fight. But I don't know that – well, I don't know. My opinion in terms of that, he can't
– preemptive damage control. Maybe he knows Mattis wants to leave. I don't know.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I just think that Mattis is nobody's bobblehead. Kelly's not a bobble. I've said this repeatedly. I know those guys. I've worked with them, you know, in Iraq, you know, when Fallujah was surrounded and got to see them under intense pressure. You know, you can put a gun in their mouths and you can tell them to say the wrong thing and they'll say, pull the trigger. I'm not doing it. I won't do it. I mean, they're not bobbleheads. And so if that's what he thought he was getting, he's a bobblehead, then obviously he's finding out that that's not the way it works. Look, I have...
And this is what sucks about politics today. Is that, you know, a story about this very subject that just went up on the news rep maybe a half an hour ago, and it's called The Man Without a Party, you know, because Mattis really, I mean, he butted heads with the Obama administration, probably costing him the job of Commandant of the Marine Corps, aside from some media gaffes like talking about how much he likes killing people. But, you know, so Mattis... In the media, in the left-leaning media, when he was first nominated for Secretary of Defense, the fact that he was Mad Dog Mattis and that he had talked about killing people made people on the left find him unstomachable. Little did they know that he's actually the warrior monk more so than he's Mad Dog Mattis, right?
Easily.
He's a big reader. He's a level-headed guy.
Easily.
You know, I have a lot of admiration for Mattis, full disclosure. You know, objectivity be damned. I really, really respect this man. I just bought Marcus Aurelius' Meditations because he said every American should read it.
Right.
I trust this guy, you know? The left does not like Mattis because he's obviously pro-military. He serves under Donald Trump, you know, and he's made these remarks in the media that don't sit well with left-leaning folks. But now the base on the right also isn't going to like Mattis because Donald Trump is putting the people in the position of having to pick one. You either like me or you like Mattis, because Mattis is basically a Democrat. So now we're dividing the party up even further. So this guy is going to end up out on an island.
I don't understand. So a Democrat, I did not see the 60 Minutes interview. Did he expand on it? Based on what? Based on his isolation?
He didn't base it on anything, but he did the usual kind of walking around the topic. You know, maybe he's going to leave. He's probably going to leave someday. Some people always leave. Everybody leaves eventually.
Right. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in why would you say he's kind of a Democrat?
The one thing I'm sure of is that when Donald Trump went in to do that interview, that was one of the bullet points that he had prepped with his staff. I do not think it was an off-the-cuff. I do not think it was a gaffe. I think it was strategic politically. The question really is, what was the motivating factor? Was it that, you know, Mattis has already said that he wants to leave at the end of the year like Haley? Is it that Donald Trump is upset about Mattis not offering support. Maybe Donald Trump even asked him to help with the campaign, and he said no. There was something that elicited this statement. I really don't think that it was at random. The question is what, you know? And regardless of what it was, I think it was a bad move, you know? I'm on record being critical of Donald Trump. When he makes good choices, I support them. I think the Space Force is a solid call.
The Space Force. All right. So the context of this is Nikki Haley leaves, turnover in his administration, blah, 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 blah. Leslie Stahl asks, will Secretary Mattis leave? The response, quote, I think he's sort of a Democrat, if you want to know the truth, the president said. But General Mattis is a good guy. We get along very well. He may leave. I mean, at some point, everybody leaves. Everybody, people leave. That's Washington. Calling, I did not know that you had written about this.
One of the good ones is the statement. Are you kidding me?
I didn't, yeah. I just found the piece that you put up there. How incredible is that? I just teed that beautiful little thing up for you. You can read it. Go to NewsRep at thenewsrep.com, and you'll see right there on the front page, A Man Without a Party. Trump calls Defense Secretary James Mattis, quote, kind of a Democrat in a hint of departure. Now, why do you use a single asterisk for that kind
of quotations in the title?
Yes.
It's the AP style book, man. You know, it's an industry standard. It's determined by the Associated Press.
Got
it. Every year, for a whole bunch of money, you get to buy another one. Or you can buy a subscription, so it's a whole bunch of money all the time. And it's just like the tax code. It's long and complicated, and you usually screw things up, and I swear they make it that complicated to keep copy editors employed. I'm just kidding, copy editors. I do love you guys. But that's one of the crazy rules. Just like you have to use a double hyphen, you can't ever use a single hyphen. And my personal pet peeve, no double spacing. You can't put two spaces after a period like I grew up doing.
Yeah, I grew up doing that. My daughter asked me. My daughter asked me, why do you put two spaces after a...
Because that's how it's done, goddammit.
Yeah, that's what I said. That's how it's done. That's how Mrs. Muser taught me that in typing class when I was a sophomore in high school. She said, what?
You know, and I've had the argument where they're like, yeah, that's for typewriters, so you can make sure to specify the space. And I was like, no, it's for typing.
Yes.
And you're just getting progressively lazier and lazier to the point where now we're even adding fewer spaces to the content that we produce. Pretty soon, it'll be emoji. I'm not down. If I had my way, I would handwrite, you know, my stories on loose leaf notebook paper and take pictures of them and post them on the website. But nobody's to do that.
In fact, my daughter said, and Mom does it too. And my ex-wife said, because we got taught that in typing. Hello. I said, yeah. It's the way we did it. She said, hmm.
And, you know, and I have an Underwood typewriter in my office that I never, ever use.
Get out.
But I have in the past. I love my typewriter. And I tell you what, I don't see any reason why I should type differently on the typewriter than I do on a computer.
I agree. Why did style change because we went to a different mechanical device? I will tell you what. You want to know one of the great inventions of modern time was the electric typewriter. If you ever typed on a manual typewriter, you had strong fingers, man, because you had to mash those keys.
I have a manual typewriter here, but in the Marine Corps, I used an electric typewriter. And the better electric typewriters aren't that different than typing on a computer. And, you know, you're typing onto like a calculator screen effectively, and then it prints.
Well, and then they came out with the autocorrect ball, where you could backspace or erase the last thing you typed.
That's more advanced than I
had. Exactly. That was like,
that's pretty good.
Whoa, that was awesome. But the electric typewriter, one of the great inventions. In fact, when you were using a manual typewriter, when you would get to your extremities, like in particular your pinkies, like you had to like develop.
Well, you have to shift your hand.
Yeah, you had to like
press the button.
Yeah, or else it's going to appear faint on the paper. See, this is.
You know, and it makes you wonder about these prolific writers of yesteryear who would just write incredible amounts of content. These guys must have had hands like plumbers. You know? like you don't imagine that when you think a writer, you know, when you even into the later era, like Hunter S. Thompson, you don't picture him as a particularly tough guy. But I bet you that guy could crush a beer can with his hands.
I think, maintaining your typewriter was pretty important, too. I think making sure that your typewriter was well lubricated. So when you hit that key, it's smoothly. Because I don't know if our typewriter was well lubricated. I don't think we ever had
a good point. I don't think I've ever performed appropriate maintenance on my typewriter.
Yeah, and as a result, you have this overdeveloped pinky finger on each hand. Like, whoa, that guy can mash it with his pinky. Why is that? He's got a shitty manual typewriter.
I tell you what, though, they look cool. You know, it's a great aesthetic piece here in my office. That's basically all it is nowadays.
So yeah, well, it's
in the Marine Corps, you'd be surprised how often you have to use a typewriter. I mean, I'd imagine even to this day. You know, there's a lot of paperwork that you use that, you know, it's already been filled out. You've already got 3 page 11 entries or what have you, and now the company has got to give you another one.
No, nobody uses
it. They use a typewriter.
No, they don't.
I mean,
nobody.
They did right up until 2012 when I got out.
Okay, yeah, I don't know where you were. I don't know what you were doing. Okay, I don't know what kind of lost world that you lived in, but yeah, typewriter.
You'd be at the Marine Corps to this day. Stop uses it. A program called MCTIS, the Marine Corps Total Force System. And it's basically a big database, and you use a couple different software suites to access the data. But the primary one's called 3270. And if you walk into any Marine Corps admin place today, you'll see these Marines using 3270. It is a black screen, green writing. You use like 4-byte codes to access, and a social security number to access. I'd imagine now they use the service number to access the files on the Marine. It's how we maintain our pay distribution systems. It's how we keep track of all personnel files. It's how we do promotion. It's like DOS-based. Still uses it to this day because it works.
Wait, did you say DOS?
Yeah, it looks just like DOS.
Stop it.
I'm not kidding you.
We're done with that. Give me your thoughts on this whole the whole Turkey-Saudi thing.
Man, this whole thing is a mess. You know?
Okay, first of all, are you going to base what you do on what the Turkish intelligence service tells you? Because in case, I said this earlier, but in case anybody doesn't know it, the largest number of missing journalists reside in what country on the planet?
Turkey.
All right. So now they somehow or other...
they're not all missing. A lot of them are just in prison. You know? Like, just on trumped-up charges of participating in a coup. This is a situation where we're talking about both of these nations. I understand Turkey's a member of NATO. I understand Saudi Arabia has been one of our strongest oil-producing allies since World War II. They're both bad guys. We deal with a lot of bad guys. You know, that's just the nature of the world. A lot of times, in order to get along, you got to go along. And sometimes it's better to maintain positive ties with bad guys than it is to let Europe fall into a state of conflict, right? So now we're talking about Saudi Arabia, where we're dependent on Saudi Arabian oil. There's no way around that, you know? And so when we talk in all this bluster about how we have to retaliate to Saudi Arabia, it's easy idealistically to make that argument because it's the right argument. The right argument is if someone did something bad and we can prove it, there should be repercussions. The problem is that right and wrong in geopolitics doesn't really matter all that much. Survival matters, right? So we need to find some way to make it look like we don't let them off the hook, but that doesn't inhibit our ability to get cheap oil. And as bad as that sounds, I want to remind everyone that we are rapidly approaching winter when the vast majority of Americans, including low-income Americans, are going to be relying on heating oil to survive. If you raise the price of that oil by 50 cents a gallon, people are going to be in tough positions. People who need to stay warm in New England and have no money are going to have trouble surviving the winter if we don't have access to economically feasible oil. We've got to play ball to a certain extent with Saudi Arabia. Turkey is a NATO ally. Now, Erdogan's a bad guy. Turkey is the Turkish government is not doing good things. I spent some time in Turkey years ago. And even then, I was like, I don't think I want anything to do with this nation. The people were lovely. The law enforcement I dealt with, the government that I kind of spoke to, not so much. I got to tell you, man, we're talking about which bad guy we want to side with here, and that's a complicated situation. It's not as simple as right and wrong.
Which one of these corrupt nations do you want to do? Do you want to cozy up to? And how are you going to sustain that relationship when, again, this guy Khashoggi, read about his background. The reason this is an issue is because he's a writer for the Washington Post. Right? Yeah. If he was a writer for Al Jazeera, which he easily could have been, he's not an American citizen. And he's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hello?
And this is really what it comes down to. Here in the United States, we've got senators and congressmen on both sides of the aisle posturing, using this topic to try to advance their own political party, right? I'm not saying I'm the one doing it worse. I'm just saying that's politics today in America. The problem with that is that political party initiatives are always soundbite initiatives.
Right.
You hear it all the time. They'll repeat the same phrase,
right,
the same three keywords in 16 different interviews, right?
Got it.
We're a soundbite-based political system now, and this topic is complicated. Complicated topics do not bode well when we're talking about soundbite politics.
Well, again, if you've spent time in the Middle East, one thing you know is if you're seeing it, you're seeing it because they want you to see it. Okay? So why is Turkey's intelligence service throwing this in front of God and everybody, to include they're going to out their own surveillance mechanisms inside the Saudi consulate? Now,
so you are asking the right question.
So why is that happening? And is it that far-fetched to think that the Turkish intelligence service could have yoked him up, right, and killed him and recorded it and then blamed it on the Saudis? Is that?
And it's important to keep in mind, anytime you're looking no intelligence agency, that includes our own, no intelligence agency releases information without motive.
So
every time you see information that comes from an intelligence agency, honestly, anytime you see information that comes from a formal government, there is a motive behind that information.
Hello.
They have an intent. You know? When we're talking about why would Turkey out parts of their own intelligence gathering apparatus to release this information, it means the end game that they're pursuing seems more valuable to them than the continued operation of that facet of their intelligence operation.
Okay, and let me just point this out, that we're talking about in every consulate, right, there is a quote unquote secure area. Okay, now if we're going to kill this guy and we're going to chop him up, right, pack him up and then take him out, that has to be done inside the Holy of Holies, okay? That's got to be done inside the vault. Turkey.
That's where you came up quick, smashing up tapes and trying not to look.
Yeah, that. So Turkey's got access to that. That's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive.
This is one of those things because I do want to walk myself back a little bit when it comes to. It's possible that they just screwed this up. I do agree with you that you don't see things coming out of the Middle East that they want you to. But I do always try to allow for the possibility of gross negligence.
Oh, no.
Russia's rash of outings in their intelligence apparatus lately kind of speaks to that. The first couple of times Russian spies got outed, I mean, there's been, I think, 8 have been outed, not counting that GRU leak that like ended up outing hundreds more, throughout Europe in the past month. And the first couple of times, everybody was like, this is smoke and mirrors, man. This is misdirection. The GRU wants people to find Russian operatives operating in England because they're doing something else. Everybody assumes Russia's got this all-powerful intelligence espionage apparatus that can do no wrong. The truth is, they kind of suck. And we're seeing that in real time right now. I think, to a certain extent, all of these nations knew that Russia had operatives operating within their borders.
Yes.
But you just kind of, you let everybody play ball. You've got operatives in their borders, they've got operatives in yours. As long as nobody's doing anything that bad, gentlemen's agreement.
Right.
But now all of a sudden we're seeing Russians' pictures posted in the newspapers, and when they can get their hands on them, we're seeing them paraded in for indictments, you know? Likewise, all of a sudden with China here in Belgium. To me, this doesn't sound like all of these intelligence gathering systems from Russia, from, you know, China's MSS is not a JV intelligence gathering apparatus. These guys are good. This indictment in Belgium is the first time ever a formal Chinese spy is being extradited to the United States. I think what we're seeing is a crackdown worldwide where people are poking at one another, Russia in particular. I think that most of Europe is wanting to point out to Russia that we're not going to put up with your shit in quite the same form anymore.
That we have. No, I don't disagree with you, but here's my point. If you're basing your position on what you've gleaned from the Turkish intelligence apparatus, you might want to check that.
Agreed.
You might want to check that.
Absolutely.
Now I would.
No, that doesn't mean there's no truth to it. But right. It means you should be skeptical.
Well, and again, so we haven't heard anything from the American intelligence establishment in terms of what they believe happened. So anyway, why? And then look, journalists going missing in the Middle East, that's a big deal. Come on. I mean, hell no, it's not. Happens all the time.
I mean, it's near and dear to my heart.
People,
you know?
When
my wife was pregnant, a news rep, soft rep at the time, asked if they could send me to Moscow to cover a story. And I was like, yeah, man, let's do this. And my wife was like, are you kidding me? I'm 6 months pregnant, and you want to go hang out in a GRU cell? Is that the plan? That's what you want to go do? And don't get me wrong, I'm sure I wouldn't have. I'm sure if I had gone to Moscow, everything would have been fine. The trip just fell through. But there is that thing. I think that this is the reason why you see stories like this with those Reuters journalists in Myanmar getting arrested. Journalists tend to cover this because it scares us. It's not even necessarily about the people being interested. It's about us wanting you to care. Because we're afraid the next one could be me. It's probably not going to be me, because I do analysis much more so than on-location reporting. But every journalist sees a journalist get snatched up or murdered, and they want the world to care. You know, I don't know that there's as much interest out there among the public as there is being pushed on them, because I think the media enterprise as a whole is like, guys, we really need you to give a shit about this.
Interesting.
Aside from the fact that it plays well into narratives here in domestic politics about President Trump not liking the media and painting them as the enemy, this plays into that narrative, so it dovetails nicely into things we're already yelling at each other about. And I think that's another reason why the story has legs.
Yeah,
not to sound too cynical.
No. I mean, look, the healthy and the appropriate viewpoint is the cynical one. First of all, find out who Khashoggi is, and not just, you know, because at first it was like, is this guy a U.S. citizen? No. He's got a green card. Okay, so he's got permanent status in the United States.
That means he can fill out paperwork and has money.
Right.
I mean,
and so, but he's a Saudi, he's a citizen of Saudi Arabia. Okay, so why is his disappearance such a huge deal? Oh, he writes on occasion for the Washington Post. Okay, so I guess that's what makes this break squelch, because if we're doing stories on every journalist or every person that goes missing in a Middle East country, from Turkey to Syria to Egypt to Jordan to Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Qatar, Somalia, that's a fairly deep list that guy's going to get on.
However, I could make an argument in favor of precedent setting. Which is, the United States doesn't really give a shit when you disappear a journalist from a country that isn't us. However, if you disappear somebody from an outlet that's American, or somebody with even remedial ties to the United States, we are going to get pissed. So that creates this buffer where the next time, if it's a U.S. journalist for the New York Times who's on location in wherever, people will think twice about wanting to kill that journalist just because it will earn the ire of the largest military in the world. there's a precedent that you could argue is worth setting there.
Well, is worth setting there.
The problem is that you don't get to pick which hill to die on when you're looking for a precedent like this, and this guy's probably not the right one.
Well, again, I just don't know. I don't know that that affects their behavior.
I think it would. It's impossible to say it would affect the behavior of bad actors worldwide. I think it's reasonable to suspect that it would affect the behavior of larger operating apparatuses. ISIS isn't going to care. ISIS wants to do whatever they can to rile you up, right? However, there are other militant groups around the world that might, a perfect example being the Philippines, probably, you know, we still maintain ties with the Philippines, we still provide them military support. If an American journalist in the Philippines got wrapped up in something, I think it's safe to say that Duterte would be less likely to order the execution of an American journalist if the assumption is that America is going to come down on you hard for it.
He's not an he's not an American journalist, though.
No, absolutely. But this is what I'm saying. When we talk about how riled up we're getting about someone with ties to the United States, it serves as a precedent for how upset we'll get about Americans.
Well, you know,
to me,
what this symbolizes is, do you remember why we went to Somalia back in the early 90s? We went because...
Well, I mean, it was effectively to stop internal corruption from messing with humanitarian aid, right?
Well, I mean, there was all this videotape that was getting pumped onto American televisions of people starving to death. And so
warlords failing to distribute, right?
Yeah. So we're seeing pictures of people laying on the roads and starving, and mothers, you know, and that.
That's troubling.
Yeah, and
it's
so
troubling that we're so easily swayed because those things are not happening right now. They're happening right now.
Exactly. And so where were we during the genocide in Cambodia?
Right? Where were we during the Rwanda genocide?
So these are significant events, but the United States is not...
Where are we in Burma right now?
Why? Because we don't have enough good video coming back from it? Is that what...
Honestly, to a certain extent?
Yes.
You know? And instead, you know, the videos of this, another story I wrote up last week, some of you guys might have seen this video shared, and some of you may have shared it yourself. There was a video of a female, you know, a feminist... protester in Russia walking around with a bleach solution in a bottle that she was pouring on the pants of men who were manspreading in the subway. Manspreading, for those who aren't like hip to Twitter lingo, is just when a guy sits with his knees spread far apart. You know, he's occupying too much space, and among some female groups they see that as offensive. So this woman was going on bleaching guys' pants with this, you know, high bleach concentrate that ruined their pants. The video was Kremlin-funded and then distributed through a Russian-owned media outlet, and immediately became viral. You know, 6 million views on Facebook alone on that initial launch, followed by it going onto YouTube and every other social media platform and getting millions of more views. A lot of the shares were people talking about how stupid feminism is because they do things like this, which engaged feminists to be like, you're stupid for saying we're stupid. And everybody got all riled up and started fighting with each other. And it turns out that was the point. The point all along was for Russia to produce a video that got us all yelling at each other, and they successfully did it. Meanwhile, as we're talking about, these videos have significant political power. If it was Kony 2012, policy could be written because of the response on Twitter about this video at this point.
Which ought to scare the living shit out of everybody.
It really is. It's disconcerting, man. It's disconcerting that the Russian government, who uses, they're not crafty. They're ballsy. There's a difference. They use audacity instead of intelligence. Russian misinformation and disinformation campaigns are by and large bad. They just do it straight-faced, looking at you right in the eye, and a certain percentage of people believe it.
Well, you know what?
They're manipulating us very easily at this point.
If you take a page out of Vladimir Putin's book, right, and what is, let's just say Saudi Arabia did yoke this guy up and kill him and chop him up.
Yeah, you know, benefit of the doubt. What's the
yeah, what would you say? Here's what I'd say. Look, we didn't do this, right? Those intelligence agents, those men that went there for this reason, okay? The audio you hear is probably the Turkish intelligence murdering him. So you should ask them. We had no part in that. That's a page right out of Vladimir Putin's book. Those little green men with no patches, they're loyalists. They're not Russian soldiers. Those trucks with painted over numbers, I mean, you can get those anywhere. But we will not stand by and allow former Russian citizens to be preyed upon by the Ukrainian government. We will move shortly.
Just like in Syria.
Right.
You said that there was chemical weapons. America must have brought them.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't America. Okay, the rebels must have chemical attacked themselves.
Exactly.
Just to elicit international support. That's the thing.
That's the way.
They established an entire infrastructure you need to build chemical weapons and then didn't use it against the enemy that's winning. Instead, used it against themselves. If there's anything we can learn from Russia, it's that no you is still an effective geopolitical argument.
Yeah.
You know, when England accused Russia of, you know, of trying to assassinate a former Russian military intelligence officer in Salisbury, England, what did Russia say? No, you did it. No, you. I bet you guys did it.
Yeah.
You know,
you're continuing this attack on Russia, attempting to alienate us economically, and it won't work.
They call it the anti-Russian conspiracy of the West. If you go on the Kremlin's website, on the Ministry of Defense website, or on Vladimir Putin's PR front-facing website, the great conspiracy of the West is repeatedly referenced. Because within Russia, and within Russia's kind of sphere of influence, nations that they're a big arms supplier for and whatnot, Russia really pushes this narrative that it's an us-versus-them world. Russia wants it to be a Russia-led us versus a U.S.-led them. The truth of the matter is it's very likely going to be a China-led us versus a U.S.-led them. But Russia really is pushing this concept that the United States and England and many of the European powers are legitimately conspiring, Alex Jones tinfoil hat conspiring, against the Russian people. It sounds crazy, but this is really the official material that's coming out of the Russian government. You can go on kremlin.mil.ru or whatever the website is, MOD, I think, .mil.ru. You can read these press releases yourself. I mean, they're translated to English for you. It's crazy, the bullshit that comes out of the Kremlin. And you have to bear in mind, within Russia, the media is overwhelmingly owned by the Kremlin. So if you think about how easy it is to influence American voters with our overall pretty shitty journalism media state that it is today. If you think about how easy it is for these private companies to do it, imagine a concerted government effort run by oligarchs that are answering to Vladimir Putin.
That would be
and then imagine what the Russian people think of us.
That would be a smooth operation. All right, I'm going to give you one more quiz, and then I'm going to I'll leave you with a little piece of information here that you're going to love. That'll show everybody how smart you are. What percentage of Asian people, right, who live in Japan, South Korea, Philippines, Indonesia, and Australia believe that the United States or China would be a world leader? What percentage do you think picked the United States? What percentage do you think picked China?
At this state, in my opinion, I'd assume the majority would pick China. Because honestly, if we're talking about staying a world power through the rest of this century, I think that China is going to take the lead within the next 50 years or so.
Okay, so here's...
So I would imagine, I'm going to call it 70%.
Okay. When asked if it would be better for the world to have the U.S. or China as a leading global power...
Better for the world.
Better for the world.
I don't know about that one. I don't have an answer for that, but...
As the leading power, 73% of Asian respondents said the United States. Only...
I'd imagine, man. China's not very well liked among most Asian nations.
Only 12% said that only 12% said China. Kind of interesting.
Well, you know, but here's where I'm gonna nitpick the study a bit.
Right.
I'd really like to see a cross section of how many of the respondents were Japanese versus Vietnamese versus Chinese. The reason why I say that is because a lot of these nations that are abutting the
All right. Hold on.
Okay.
Japanese 81%. Philippines 77%. South Korea 73%. Australia 72%. Indonesia 43%. Still a majority. China was
30, unbelievable.
China was 22%. Undecided 35%.
So, you know, the South China Sea is a much bigger deal than most Americans realize it is. And I think that for people in that region of the world, they're more savvy to that. And China's attempts at claiming sovereignty over all of it, which is the livelihoods for a lot of these nations. People don't realize it's not only, you know, where a third of international trade is shipped over, it's also some of the most bountiful fishing territory in the world. It's also got some of the largest oil reserves in the world.
Natural gas, yeah.
And a lot of these nations, China trying to call dibs on the South China Sea means ruin for them.
Well,
you know?
And again, the way the world is cut up, every country has a 200-mile economic exclusion zone.
Absolutely.
That borders it. China says, yeah, we're not playing that game. They drew a line down the Vietnamese coast, down to Malaysia, right, over to the Philippines and up, and says, this belongs to us. Then,
now, it's important for people, as you can't picture stuff like I have trouble picturing it. Just bear in mind that this seven-dash line that he's talking about, it extends thousands of miles away from China's shores. We're not talking about, like, a country calling dibs on the water right near them. We're talking about thousands of miles south of China, where this water is touching five other nations. They're saying it's theirs as well.
Okay, it's a
portion of the ocean.
It's a nine-dash line, goddamn.
Nine-dash line, my God, nine-dash line.
But, yeah, no, I mean, you look at it, you look at it.
Of course, they have a historical claim of it. You know, they claim, it's called the South China Sea, man. It's got to be ours. Our name's on it.
Right. And again, then the Philippines takes them to the law of high seas, some court like that, that's affiliated with the Hague, in the Netherlands, right? And they side with the Philippines. But the Philippines will not implement the decision because they're afraid of the Chinese and what the Chinese will do if they decide.
These islands in the South China Sea, so in the middle of the South China Sea, there's a bunch of little islands and reefs, some of which you guys might have heard of. China actually built up with barges of sand,
yep.
And then put military assets, anti-aircraft, anti-ship, landing strips, barracks on these islands so that they could then claim that that island there is part of their sovereign territory. So their economic exclusion zone extends 200 miles out in all directions from that island.
Yes.
And the way they pressure other countries to give up these islands is they literally use siege tactics. They park their very quickly growing navy in a circle around an island, and they don't let Philippines or other Vietnamese supply ships come in. It's how they ran the Vietnamese off their own oil platforms.
Yeah, and they've torpedoed two Vietnamese oil exploration deals with private companies. All right, one final thing. Back to time zones. Time zones were developed in the 19th century because, and you correctly, very astute, I'm impressed, trains had to run on time. Up until that point.
I think that makes me right, like, for one out of five.
It does. No, impressive.
But as long as we can close on the one I got right.
But it didn't matter what time it was in Prague because, you know, you got there so slowly, it wouldn't matter. But in the U.K., Scotland, right, England, and then Ireland, right, things had to run on time, so they had to come up with time zones in order to make sure that trains and shipping ran on time. And then it branched out from there, other nations adopting and using Greenwich Mean Time, blah, blah, blah.
I was going to say, I would imagine it was in Greenwich then, right, that the first came up with this idea?
There you have it. So that's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. So, all right, you can find Alex's work. First of all, give it a read. A Man Without a Party, Trump calls Defense Secretary James Mattis, quote, kind of a Democrat, unquote, in hint of departure. You can find that on thenewsrep.com. His name is Alex Hollings. What else you got what else is coming to market?
There's going to be a bunch of stories coming out on the News Rep and on another website called the Loadout Room this week from me about Petit Le Mans, which is an endurance race. They run three different classes, prototype and two classes of GT Cup cars simultaneously on the same racetrack. I know a lot of people might not have – a lot of Americans are more interested in NASCAR than they are in this type of racing. My coverage is really not for the racing insider. I worked in racing for a long time, but the coverage of this event is really more about – how this is just, this is a cross-section of America that a lot of people might not realize and may be a bit intimidated by. And the intent of my going to this event and covering it was trying to draw the parallels between working in racing and serving in the military, which, in my opinion, there are many. Take a look out for that. You'll see stories about Petit Le Mans coming out from me on a couple different websites. I'm excited about it only because it's a little bit good news. You know, I spent a lot of time writing about bad news. So you should see it on thenewsrep.com and theloadoutroom.com here within the next couple of days.
His name is Alex Hollings. As you can tell from that comment on why time zones got created, he's a smart guy. And our thanks to you for coming on again, Alex. Have a good one.
Hey, thanks a lot, brother. I'll talk to you later.
There you have it. The one and only Alex Hollings. We're going to take a quick break. Michael Musselman, the gunner, will join us next here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only, the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans.